Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your regular taste of the latest treats from the world of technology. My name's Bobby Johnson and I'm standing in for Alex Kwiatkowski, ready to cook up the latest batch of interviews and news for you to digest. In this episode, we'll hear how the banks are battling to stay ahead of online fraudsters, with two of the industry's experts telling us about their cutting-edge techniques.
Part of the trick is, how do you actually find something suspicious in such a large volume of activity and actually produce a small enough amount of suspicious cases for people to be able to work in a month?
Also this week, we'll hear how a software company based in Uganda is bringing internet access to some of the most disconnected villages in Africa. And if that's not enough, we've got a little appetizer of news for you, as well as a rich dessert of your comments to tuck into before the end of the show. So grab your knife and fork and get your high-tech taste buds ready. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Last week, an American man agreed to plead guilty to charges surrounding the theft of some 45 million credit card details in one of the largest cases ever of its kind. Alberto Gonzalez, also known online as Soup Nazi, was accused of masterminding the identity theft that struck at major retailers across the United States in 2007. Online fraud is one of many problems that's plagued the banking sector in recent years, and while you may think that deleting those badly worded email scams from your inbox means you're immune from cybercrime, well, the Soup Nazi case shows that online fraudsters are becoming more and more savvy all the time. Dr. Michael Recchi was previously the chief scientist for Fortent, a company specialising in combating money laundering and online fraud. It was recently sold to a rival, Actimize. He told The Guardian's Charles Arthur how the battle is shaping up.
I was an artificial intelligence professor at University College London. At that point in time in the late 80s and early 90s, there was lots of interest in applying artificial intelligence to credit scoring and looking for suspicious trading activity in the exchanges. And we addressed the particular problem of finding suspicious transactions in bank activity.
How do you recognize them? What is it that's different about a suspicious activity, a money laundering thing that's not like you or me sort of buying something?
Well, at the risk of giving the secret away, I mean, there is really a fairly straightforward way to detect those folks, because normal customers are creatures of habit and really don't want to transact with banks very often. They go to banks infrequently and always go to the same place. Bad guys, in order to, they think, avoid suspicion, go to lots and lots of different banks and do lots and lots of different transactions, because they want each transaction to be small and they don't want the personal contact. And so by their nature of the diversity and frequency of their activity, they make themselves look suspicious.
How broad does it have to work? Because are you just looking at accounts a bit, and the in and out of accounts and where money is put in or withdrawn, or are you looking across a broader range of transactions?
We're looking at all transactions, really. We're looking at all transactions, both the financial transactions as well as changes of address and balance inquiries, and now with the Actimize, internet access, activity of employees, you know, as they check accounts to look for identity theft and things like that.
There must be a huge volume of transactions they have to analyze.
Yeah, it's hundreds of millions of transactions a day in single institutions. So, and since we're basically processing those transactions for the majority of large banks, it's a very large amount of transactions. And that's part of the trick, is how do you actually find something suspicious in such a large volume of activity and actually produce a small enough amount of suspicious cases for people to be able to work in a month or a day?
I suppose there's also the problem that it's moved from being a batch sort of process before you had the internet and internet banking to having to be a real-time process now.
And that's where part of the benefit of the combination of the Fortent approach and Actimize is actually such a success, because Actimize specializes in real-time processing and Fortent's really been in the batch processing, which is, you know, at the end of the day, all the transactions at a bank are sort of put into the computer. But for things like authorizations and credit cards, you have to be able to decide as someone's waiting for their card to be authorized whether it's suspicious or not.
So you're analyzing those sorts of things as well?
Absolutely. So we're now in the process with Actimize of analyzing individual transactions during the authorization process to see if it's fraud or not.
That sounds like a hell of a big task, because, you know, what we tend to see is that fraud in terms of, you know, money being taken is rising year on year. The advent of chip and PIN doesn't seem to have made that much impact on the overall level of card fraud, whereas you know, although some forms have fallen, other forms have risen to more than make up for it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's lots of fraud. In fact, in bad economies, there's more employee frauds and the sorts of frauds that occur in bad economies, like the one we're experiencing now. The flip side that creates an advantage is that everything's all computerized. All the transactions, whatever form they are in, are now on computers. So it becomes, if you want, easier, in fact, to see everything, see all aspects, see across all channels of individuals' activity. Because, again, in the earlier years, I mean, even a few years ago, people would sell fraud to a single channel, just checks, just debit cards. And fraudsters would actually do a little bit here, a little bit there, and spread their activity across multiple channels. Now the trick is looking across all channels and finding what's suspicious.
Is there a difficulty as the sort of the breadth of it has grown, that the false positives, when you accuse someone of fraud where they've not done it, is more costly to the bank than just missing a few bits of fraud that otherwise wouldn't be a problem?
And that's exactly right. And that's where the cleverness of the software is important, because lots of the older techniques were just really simple rules. And you could generate such a degree of false positives and irritate so many of your customers by turning off their transactions or stopping their activity. But now with some of the sort of more clever statistical techniques, you can actually separate them out. In fact, in our business, it's not unusual to have 20% of the cases be real. And by the time someone's looked at, they can tell whether it's someone sold a house, or someone had a bank error transaction in their account, or someone's really laundering money.
How many cases would you get a day?
Well, so in a say a typical bank of with 50 million accounts, you might get 1,000 cases a month for money laundering. And they look at the 1,000 cases a month through the month to figure out, and they'd have to analyze them. Now, it's a different world when talking about some of the fraud cases, like debit card fraud, because now there's some cases where, one of the things that, again, fraudsters help you, they'll do things like they know that cards, your maximum limit changes at midnight. So they'll do something just 5 minutes before midnight, 5 minutes after midnight, taking the max. They'll do things like try multiple times. They don't know what your ATM limit is, so they'll try lots of different numbers. And so some of the aspects of their activity sort of give them away. And so you can see on the bank side that someone's doing something that doesn't look normal for that card. You know, the population's divided by those who buy on the internet, those who don't buy on the internet. All of a sudden, buying on the internet could actually be a highly suspicious activity.
Bruno Piers, you're the chief executive for Europe for Actimize. Europe, I would have thought, because it's got multiple countries, some of them have different implementations of chip and PIN, and there's lots of potential for money laundering. I would have thought that Europe is a bigger challenge than perhaps the US.
It is indeed, and as you said, the technique of fraud across Europe are completely different. In terms of fraud, it's very interesting to see that actually the south part of Europe is mainly attacked by North African type of people, while actually more Germany, Belgium, and part of the UK is attacked by East Bloc countries. So the level of technology of the attackers is very different. So, of course, the attacks are different in there. The very easy one is what we call the phishing. So you receive an email which should be from your bank, but it's not, and ask you to fill. We know that usually a phishing attack generates, per round of attack, around 4,000 people responding to it, create a huge problem for the bank. Today, mainly the folks coming from East country come with very sophisticated technology. The most advanced one is called the man in the browser, where basically you start an internet session with your bank, and basically while you're in, so you went through all the security step that you have to go through, they take over when you exit. So they continue to do transaction using your bank account. The system thinks it's you, and surprisingly, the day after, your bank account is empty.
So this is the reason why, for example, your bank will tell you to quit your browser and so on when you finish with your bank's session, is it?
That's right.
Michael, what do you see as the future of this sort of analysis of transactions? Because a complaint that a lot of people have, I think, is that when their account starts being used fraudulently, that often it's incredibly hard for them to prove or to persuade the bank that that's happened and to get a refund on the money as they're due under the banking code in the UK.
Yeah, well, I think it's there is going to be, and there is already, like in internet security, this sort of back and forth between the hackers and the protectors, and so we have to continue to advance with our methods to to be better at detection as people try to get better at avoiding. And part of that is, as I was saying earlier, is looking across more and more channels and being able to look at all the full range of activity that of bad guys at institutions. And, you know, and there are aspects of that that also have to do with people trying to avoid detection by using a different name, you know, at some institutions, or trying to adjust their address. And so we do sophisticated linkage analysis to see who's linked from, you know, interestingly, you have people who would use a different name, use a different slight variation of the address, but the postman still likes it, but then use the same mobile number. And so you were able to sort of, you know, find linkages or linkage through intermediate parties in order to get the full picture of someone's activity.
That was Bruno Piers, the head of Actimize Europe, talking to Charles Arthur. And earlier you heard from Dr. Michael Recchi. And if you're looking for more information on online fraud and how to stay safe, then just go to guardian.co.uk/technology, where we'll have loads of links for you. Now it's time to catch up on some of the week's top news headlines.
The alleged Pentagon hacker, Gary McKinnon, is making yet another attempt to escape extradition to the US, this time by appealing to the Supreme Court of England and Wales. His legal team argues that his case, which has been rejected so far by every British court, should be heard under the European Convention on Human Rights. The Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, has apologised for the British government's treatment of the legendary computer pioneer Alan Turing. Winston Churchill said Turing had made the biggest single contribution to the Allies' victory over the Nazis. But just a few years after leading Britain's successful efforts to crack the German Enigma code, the mathematician was found guilty of homosexuality and forced to endure chemical castration, eventually leading him to kill himself in 1954, something Gordon Brown says was appalling. The American biotechnology pioneer Norman Borlaug has died, aged 95. He won the Nobel Prize for his work on creating new strains of wheat that revolutionised agriculture in the developing world. Borlaug was credited with creating high-yield wheat that was more resistant to disease and responsible for saving the lives of more than a billion people over the last 40 years. And finally, the Microsoft boss Steve Ballmer grabbed an employee's iPhone at a company event and pretended to smash it to bits in front of a huge audience. Ballmer is well known for his exuberant on-stage appearances, in contrast to the Apple boss Steve Jobs, who made his first public appearance in almost a year last week, speaking on the record about his recent liver transplant for the first time.
And if you want more on those stories and many others, then just go to guardian.co.uk/technology. One of the challenges that Africa faces this century is the growing divide between those who have access to the internet and those who don't. And while things have improved for many people, particularly with the recent opening of a new submarine cable that should bring broadband to East Africa, it remains the most unconnected continent in the world. That's a divide that the American software developer John Gosia, who is based in Uganda, is trying to bridge with his company, Africa. He aims to bring the benefits of internet access closer to those in the country's poorest villages, who've never experienced it before. Kevin Anderson caught up with him recently and started by asking John how he got started.
So the idea is to, you know, we always talk about democratizing information. This is essentially trying to bring the internet to... make it available to people in rural populations. People who are far enough off the grid that they really do have no access to the web. You know, some people don't even know, you know, about the internet, but they still have questions. So it's all about trying to get them information, and you know, the service works by them calling operators who are using this offline search engine to look up the answers to their questions. And we've received massive amounts of data from like Grameen, from other partners that allow us to answer sort of any and all question pretty effectively. And if we can't answer it, we don't. We find the correct answer and then we get back to it.
So basically you've got someone who's in a village who's identifies himself with a t-shirt,
right,
and they're taking the questions on a mobile phone.
Correct. And then they call our center, and that's our sort of artificial control to keep, you know, the masses from calling the system, because we just can't handle it. It's very small. It's three people right now, three operators.
So what are some of the questions that you're getting right now?
What religion is Barack Obama? We get that one a lot because they hear the things about him maybe being Muslim. And then there's, you know, my favorite question was, who created God? That's an actual question.
So what's the point of these questions?
So the point of sharing them or the point of collecting?
Both.
Okay. So the point for us is to democratize information. So in a way that's accessible to the illiterate, people who don't speak English as the first language, and people who may be too poor to even afford a mobile. In one form, there's an actual physical box that you can approach and ask the question for free, and then it calls us, you still, service works the same, it's just we're providing a free booth for them to use. And then in other areas, you just use your mobile through the CKW, or through the proxy person.
And now with this information, I mean, what are people hoping to find out by the questions that people are asking?
So I think there's a couple of organizations who found ways, you know, we've sort of conceived ways that people might be able to use the information. So, for instance, we get a lot of health questions from very specific areas. We know exactly where these questions are coming from. And they're asking about things like reproductive health. They're asking about, maybe some localized disease. And maybe there's some way we can help organizations who can provide a solution just target these areas. And it's different than trying to do a huge scoping study, which is going to take like years and, you know, months maybe. And, it's a direct line to the problem. And you're hearing from the people who have the problem that, maybe they're not looking for the solution in the form of like someone coming to help them. They're looking for a solution that maybe they can do themselves, and maybe people have that information. So we want to play the bridge between, you know, people who need help and the organizations.
John Gosia there talking to Kevin Anderson, and you can find more about the Africa project at worldwantstoknow.com. Now that's more or less it for this week's menu, but there's always time to chew over your comments. A bit quiet on the blog last week, but there was plenty of chat on Twitter. Remember, you can follow the show at Guardian TW. First up, Rob Jewett said that guest Howard Rheingold gave as good a reason as possible for teaching critical media skills. Now, I hope that was a positive comment. I think it was. Meanwhile, Two Hits the Six said that he was glad to catch up on a few weeks of shows because he feels behind the times if he misses them. And that's very sweet and very nice to know that you care. Over on Facebook, Simon Thurston was commenting on our recent show from the Singularity University in Silicon Valley, and he got stuck into some detailed commentary. It's like hearing about training for spies, he wrote. It almost seems like a secret too, despite all they're doing to make it known. That sort of high-level training for people to become better future leaders, private or public, isn't something I was really aware of, and sounds like a very new but great thing to have. Interesting comments, Simon. They conflict a little bit with some of the other things that listeners said last week, but all interesting nonetheless. To all our Facebook friends, by the way, I'm planning to give the group a bit of love very soon. I admit, and I have admitted before, that it's been a little neglected recently, but we're going to come back strong, don't worry. And last but not least, following last week's quip about how slowly I talk, Mark Stedman said I was an awesome sport. Thanks, Mark. No offence taken. And I promise it's the last time I'll mention it. Anyway, if you've got something to say about any of the topics up for discussion this week, then you can leave your comments on the blog at guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where you can also find details on how to follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group. That's it for this edition of Tech Weekly, so thanks to our guests Michael Recchi, Bruno Piers and John Gosia, as well as to the inestimable talents of Charles Arthur and Kevin Anderson, almost unpronounceable talents there. This week's show has been produced by Phil Maynard, and my name's Bobby Johnson. Thanks for listening, and see you next Tuesday.